years ago, and one time, Kay Carey,
yes,
who knew a secret about Charlie's business.
Well, he's the only one that mentioned this. I never mentioned it. I never said I am superior because my clients are innocent or superior. No word was ever passed except what I'm about to tell you. And one time, and the first time, and the next to the only time that anybody ever said anything to me about it was once Mr. Carey said quietly and in his courteous way. He was an extremely courteous man. And he said, Charlie, this time I've got the good guy. Now, I don't remember who the people were. All I remember is what Bill Carey said. And I didn't make any response to it. It was all over and done with. And it wasn't important at all. And then later, one dark night, Mr. Carey was intercepted by the LeGrand police and charged with driving while under the influence. And he asked me to defend him, and I did. And we had a trial, and the jury found him not guilty. After the trial was over, he and I came up to this house right here, and I got out the gin bottle and some other stuff and some ice, and I manufactured a couple of drinks, one for him and one for me. And so here we were sitting here sipping on the drinks, and out of the clear blue, Carey said to me, Charlie, you really do have the good guys. That was the end of it.
That's, Carey is C-A-R-E-Y. Is that how you spell his name?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Coming back to the Promise Keepers.
I would want to ask you, though, about the influence of the Promise Keepers and other religious people in the community. Is there infighting that you've seen? You said you hadn't seen anti-Catholicism among the local Promise Keepers.
Well, these papers that I have, and you're welcome to look at them, they claim that they ought to read a little of it.
Okay, but I'm interested in just the local aspect of it.
As far as I know, there isn't anything here that sets this thing apart as local. I have not heard any conflict between the Promise Keepers and other religion, except in this article by Mr. Reynolds of the Foundation magazine, and what he says, and I read it, throughout the centuries, the Roman Catholic Church has been an enemy of all true believers, and the blood of hundreds of thousands of martyrs is upon its hands. Well, this is going a little too far, you know, but anyhow,
Okay, but there was, back in your memories of what you saw with the Ku Klux Klan, that there's a similarity.
There sure is.
And that claim was divisive, that somebody's bad.
Yep, the Klan was divisive, and definitely, and we have gone through the the history, and we know that. I don't know how divisive this Promise Keepers is, but for some reason, I don't know what it is, but they don't cotton to having women in the group. No women, just men.
Have they done anything locally with women who are interested in a better place in the world?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so? Okay.
No. My former friend, I don't know what that means. Anyway, my friend Gene Sutton has a wife that was, what is her job down at the courthouse?
I don't know, Charlie.
Well, she's in charge of the tax collections, I think. Not the fixing the amount, but keeping the records.
Do you know her name?
Well, I did. I don't know right now. But she's a good woman, and she's been there for a good many years. And once you get a job in that courthouse, they'll never let you go.
Okay, but her husband is a Promise Keeper.
I think so.
He was.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. The Grand Ronde Valley is famous for wind from time to time. And this story has to do with the wind in the Grand Ronde Valley. From the very beginning, the people that got here and put down any kind of roots at all would grow food, grain crops, wheat. That has been the principal grain crop in this valley and a lot of other places. And when you're growing wheat, in order to use it, you have to grind it. You can't just eat the raw grain, as you well know. So wherever there's grain, there are grist mills. And the grist mills have a way of grinding the grain so that it ends up as flour and other small particles of the original grain. The grist mill operates with two, usually, in a simplified form, two huge stones, the upper and the nether millstone. You've heard the word.
Yeah.
And they turn and the grain is put between them and it grinds it. So this was the custom here years ago after people got going with the wheat and so forth. Then somebody built a grist mill out near Elgin. And the farmer took the grain to the grist mill and they ground it. But they had a little bad luck because I mentioned the winds. And the wind started to blow. And it blew the wrong way. And it had an effect on the grist mill and the ground grain. And the wind caused the grist mill to reverse its operation. And it unground all of that grain.
When did this story supposedly take place?
Elgin.
Elgin. Was this the Elgin flour mill?
I don't know.
It was a tall structure that burned about 1995.
I don't really know. It's just a story.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it has any
relevance to the real world.
All right, say it that way. That's a good idea.
Well,
I do suppose that that isn't really what this history thing is about. I think it's about the community. And I have more or less limited what I've said to things that have occurred in and about and through the community.
Okay, one personal thing I don't think you have mentioned on the tapes we've done is your wife's name.
My wife's name is, or was, Donna.
Donna, okay.
And we were married about 50 years. She died last October, right here.
Okay.
And she originated and was born and raised in Ohio. She came out here in 1948. And she got a job working downtown for somebody, Jimmy Trimble and his wife Eleanor. And then shortly thereafter she started working for me, and she worked for me until we both quit
at the end of 1979.
All right, now there's one other thing that is so personal, but it does distinctly draw on the community, and it is tied in with the communities to an extreme situation. Now here's the reason, and I'll make it as short as I can. I came here fresh out of law school. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a car to drive. I didn't have anything. I had a wife. That was my first wife. Her name was Melba. Very shortly after I got here, a man came to my office, which cost me $15 a month. And his name was James Moore, and he was the head man in the Grand Ronde Hospital. He was the manager of the hospital. And he had, when he came into my office, a thick book with a lot of loose leaves in it, I guess you might call it. And the message was very short. This was near the end of the Great Depression, and a lot of people during that time had to have various services and couldn't pay for them, and so their debts were in the book the man had in his hand. He had the account book of hundreds of people that owed the hospital. He asked me if I would consider trying to collect those accounts. Well, I didn't have anything else to do, so I did that. Now, anybody knows, or should know, that a bill collector is not a popular person. So, any sensible person would realize that undertaking to collect these past due accounts would not have made me very popular in the community. But they would be wrong. It didn't change a thing. It never interfered with the people's opinion of me, or where they went to select a lawyer. Never. There were other individual instances that I think of now and then. For instance, one farmer here was driving down the street in LaGrande. He had a woman in the crosswalk. She came to me, and I filed an action for damages for her. And it went to trial, and I don't remember just what happened, but we collected something for her from the farmer that hit her. Now, one would suppose that the farmer would not feel friendly toward me. Wrong. He is always been, he has always been my friend through, in spite of that, never had a thing to do with it. For one time I was trying to make beer at home. I needed some grain to make malt. Barley. He gave it to me. A huge sack of barley so that I could make beer. Never was a word ever said about the fact that I had filed a suit against him and so forth and so on. Never, not a word. This is only one slight instance. It has been repeated time after time, year after year. Never, never did I lose friendship, accommodation, all the good feelings that exist or could exist between people. I never lost a thing.
Back to the original question about collecting debts for Grand Ronde Hospital.
Yeah.
Was that a serious problem at the end of the Depression
yes,
when you
it
first
was.
Came here?
Yes, it was. These poor people couldn't pay.
What other areas were their debts other than the hospital and the effect on the local economy?
There were lots of them because this was a widespread catastrophe all over the United States, and people had to keep eating. And one of my friends operated a grocery store down here a little ways. And we knew some of the people that couldn't pay, and they would run a bill there until finally things got better. They would pay it off and everything went on.
So this was a community issue.
Oh, well, yes, it was a United States issue.
What other areas do you think? Food and medical care.
Well, I'll be glad to tell you. From time to time, I had a client and so forth and so on. And one of my clients was accused of stealing some corral poles. Now in Chicago, I don't think you have much to do with corral poles, but corral poles are made with slender little young trees that grow in the forests around here, and they're valuable to people that have cattle in order to make enclosures, corrals, so that the cattle can be controlled. One of my clients was charged with stealing some corral poles that a farmer had thought were his. Well, whether they were or not, my client had a defense, and it was successful. he had contacted a foreman of a bridge crew that was building a bridge just this side of Elgin. That's where this all took place. And he asked, when you get through with those poles that they're using for temporary scaffolding, what are you going to do with them? Phil said, well, I'll just lay them here. So my client said, well, can I have them? And the man said, the foreman said, yes. So when they got the bridge built, and you go over it every day, just this side of Elgin, my client went and picked up the poles. But a farmer had cut some corral poles, or had them cut out in the forest, and he thought that the poles that my client got were his poles. Well, we're talking about poles, aren't we? Well, so he charged my client with pole thievery. And we had a trial. I defended him. And the farmer and his wife testified. And I am sure that they were considerably offended by my approach to this case and the work in the trial court. And the verdict was in favor of my client, and from that day, for a long time, I would see this man, this farmer. I didn't see his wife because she was home, but he'd be wandering around town taking care of his business. And where we had originally at least could be courteous with each other, after this trial we could not. He was definitely aggravated, and he bore a grudge against me, and I don't blame him a damn bit. Not because I'm confessing that I was unfair in the way I tried a case. I don't think I was, but he thought I was, and that's good enough. And I'd see him downtown, and he wouldn't speak to me. He wouldn't look at me. I always greeted him, but nothing good happened. Until one day, I was down in an automotive shop at Goss Motors, doing something, bought a vehicle, and I heard somebody call me from behind. Hey, Charlie! Turned around and looked, and it was this man. And he said to me, hey, Charlie, Wheeler and I are going over on the lower Grand Ronde and go hunting. Come along with us. I'll furnish the horses. You can have a horse. And that's horse country, you know, where we were going to ride. You had to be there. You had to have a horse and saddle. He said, I'll furnish the whole thing, and I've got a truck, and we'll carry those horses down there, and then we'll go hunting. So I said, sure, that'd be fine. His brother-in-law lived right across the street from me.
Do you remember the man's name? This is the farmer that you had a dispute with.
You want to know the man's name that invited me to go hunting with him?
Mm-hmm.
It was Dick Hibbard.
Okay.
H-I-B-B-E-R-D.
Okay, he's from Imler. There's a Hibbard farm outside of Imler.
Well, yes, that's where it is.
Okay.
To make a long story short, we went hunting. Clark Wheeler, Hibbert's brother-in-law, and I didn't kill anything, but Dick did. And he dressed it out on the spot and took the liver out and just tossed it, I'm sure that's what he did, under the front seat of his pickup. Now, the front seat of any pickup is dirty underneath the seat. Every one of them. And that piece of liver collected a lot of dirt. So, the evening came, and we were hoping to eat some supper, you know. And Clark Wheeler took charge of that liver, and he cleaned it up. And he cleaned it up perfectly. That's only part of the story. My horse threw a shoe. Dick knew there was a ranch near where we were camped. He took my horse and found the man and the equipment, and he fixed my horse's shoe. And that's the end of that story. But ever after that, he and I were friends. We hunted together, we fished together, and how do you explain that? How do you explain that?
Yeah, I asked Charlie about his hunting and people he's known in the area, and also I'd like to know where you hunted in Union County.
All right. My hunting partner for a number of years was Howard Peterson. He was an inspector at the mill. He was a lumber grader. Another one was a man, Clark Hyatt, who worked at Goss Motors. He started working there as a parts expert, a parts man, and that is an expert job. And then one day, Mr. Goss came to him and said, "Clark, how'd you like try selling cars?" Well, he said, "I'll try," and he did. He was a top salesman.
Where did you hunt with him? What parts of the
Wenaha. Country? On the Wenaha. I think that's right, yes. There's a stream that flows east and west, north of La Grande, in a deep canyon. It flows into the Grand Ronde River at Troy, T-R-O-Y.
Okay, the northern part of Union County.
Yes. And other places. We hunted, we went to Wyoming and hunted once, and Clark, I'm sure, was with us, and then another man, a railroader, can't think of his name right now. And then I hunted with Fred Bell, who operates a place where people live in motorhomes. It's a motorhome park out here just east of downtown La Grande. And there are others. I had a vast group of friends. One of them was the man that I mentioned earlier, Gene Sutton. He's a retired Navy SEAL. No, not SEAL. CB. Different. And one time I wanted to go hunting and I didn't have anybody to go with me. He volunteered to go with me, although he didn't have a license to do what I wanted to do. He went with me anyway, just to keep me company. Worked out good. I didn't kill anything, but a lot of times people that go hunting don't kill things. But it'd be pretty hard to throw a rock downtown or any place in the Grand without hitting somebody that I hunted or fished with, because I spent a lot of time at it. I spent a lot more time at it than you would think would be available to a busy lawyer. But I did it anyway.
It sounds like this was a pretty common activity for men.
Oh, yes.
Did women ever go on these hunting
trips? My wife did.
She did.
If you look right down here and you go out that other door, and you see...